Hi everyone, my name is Larry Adams and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic.
Amen.
It's good to be here. Don't let this white suit fool you. I used to go out like this and come home looking like a coal miner. I bought this suit, my wife told me I looked like an ice cream man. But we was in California and I bought this suit and I come out and I said, "How's it look?" She said, "You look like a California pimp." But I told her I was going to wear it tonight, whether it looked out of place or not, so I'm glad we had the red, white, and blue together. It's a joy to be in Georgia. I want to thank Jerry and the committee for having me here. Nice to be south, you know. I've been doing a lot of traveling up north, and it's always nice to be in the south where the hospitality is so warm. I've met a lot of wonderful people and met some people I know, and it's just been a delightful trip for me and my wife. I want to introduce my wife before I get started. We've been hanging around together for 38 years, and we've done a lot of things together, some good and some bad, but I want to introduce my wife, Barbara. Stand up, Barbara. How she stayed with me 38 years, I'll never know. I tried every way in the world to get rid of her, but she hung in pretty good. We had about 17 years of the heavy, hard drinking. And when I celebrated my 17th AA birthday, I told her we was even. You don't ever tell an Al-Anon that. She looked at me and said, "How about the dry drunks?" So I ain't never going to get even, you know. But we have a lot of fun today, and I'm glad we're in sobriety, you know, because our lives has changed so much. And it's just delightful being here. I want to thank Dennis for that wonderful talk he gave Friday night to start this conference. And Linda, to give the Al-Anon talk today, I watched Linda when her and Rip was courting. Where you at, Linda? I know you're hiding back there some way. And, you know, just to get to hear her and a beautiful love story that she told today. You know, I love going to meetings, whether they're AA meetings or Al-Anon meetings. And, you know, I like to hear people tell their stories because that's what kept me coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I felt so different when I got here. You know, I was sure nobody had done the things that I had done. And I remember going to my first meeting, and a guy got up to talk, and he talked about talking to a vacuum cleaner. And he made me laugh. I thought, that old boy's crazy. And I went back to my second meeting, and a guy talked about drinking wine and crapping in his pants. And I said, I'm in the right place. You know, I could identify with them guys, and I'm so grateful that they took the time to get up and tell their stories. Sometimes in AA today, you don't hear much of that, you know, and it's what I love to hear, and it's what I'm going to do tonight. They call them drunk logs, and that's what Bill and Dr. Bob did. They told each other their stories. And that's what the book tells us to do in a general way. I'm going to tell a joke. I don't know whether to tell this joke or not. It's about a judge, and I understand we got one here tonight. So I'm probably going to have to make an amend after the meeting, but I'm going to tell it anyhow. I like to tell jokes on judges. I've never been a judge, but I've been in front of a lot of them. So if I tell a joke on them, it seemed, you know, it reminded me and my wife when I heard it. This judge was an alcoholic, and he wanted to get out of the house one night and get drunk. And he told his wife, he said, "Honey, I got to go down to the courthouse and work on some papers." He said, "I'll be back after a while." And he left, and he went to his favorite beer joint and began to drink. And during the course of the night, he got sick, and he threw up all over the front of his shirt. And driving home that night, he thought, "What am I going to tell my wife?" So he tiptoed in the door. He took his shirt off, threw it down the laundry hamper. The next morning, he got up and got ready to go to the courthouse. His wife was standing at the front door with his briefcase. He started out, and she said, "Say, what happened to you last night?" He said, "Well, what do you mean?" She said, "Well, I was downstairs doing the laundry, and your shirt had vomit all over the front of it." And he said, "Oh," he said, "I meant to tell you about that." He said, "I was down at the courthouse last night, and a drunk come in." He said, "They brought a drunk in. I was trying to help with that drunk. He threw up all over the front of my shirt." He said, "But don't you worry about it. When he comes in front of that bench this morning, I'm going to give him 30 days. And his wife said, "You ought to give him 90 days. He said, "How come 90? She said, "He done something in your pants, too." That was me and Barbara. You know, I could tell him, but she was always one step ahead of me. I want to tell you that there's three kinds of drinkers in the world. There's a social drinker, there's a heavy drinker, and there's the alcoholic. And I'll tell you how you tell the difference. A social drinker will go into his favorite bar and he'll order a drink. And the waitress will bring him a drink and set it down. He'll get ready to drink it. He'll look down and see there's a fly in it. And he'll holler for the waitress. He'll say, "Ma'am, there's a fly in my drink. Will you please bring me a new one?" She'll bring him a new one, he'll drink it. Now the old heavy drinker will walk into that same bar and he'll order a drink. And he'll look down, see there's a fly in his. He'll take the fly out, lay it on the bar, and drink the drink. And I'm going to tell you about an alcoholic like me. I'll go in that same bar and I'll look down and see there's a fly in it. I'll reach down and grab him and holler, spit it out. I don't want him to get none of my drink, you know. I want it all. And that's the way I drink. I was a pig from the word go. I want to tell you that I was from an alcoholic home. I was born in Louisville, Kentucky. I want to tell you before I start my sobriety dates, November the 7th of 1978. My home group's the Shavley Group in Louisville, Kentucky, and my sponsor's an old crusty guy that's been here before named Jack S. Now, I do call him Jack S today. I used to call him Jack Ass. But he gets the word back, so I'm going to have to quit doing that, you know. But I was born in an alcoholic home. We lived in a section of Louisville, down in a rough section of Louisville. It was called Portland. Beer joint on every corner, large Catholic families. It was a Catholic neighborhood. Now, we wasn't Catholics, but my daddy took lessons from them because there wound up being 13 kids in our family. He really took lessons from them. There was 9 boys in that family, and I want to tell you what, I seen alcoholism from a young kid. My daddy was an alcoholic, I know that today. And I remember my dad would stop at the beer joint on Friday night, and he would come home, and there was hell at our house. Because my daddy and mother would begin to argue, and I remember as a little kid, I would crawl under the bed, and I'd hear my mom and dad arguing, and I can remember my dad running my mother through the house with butcher knives. And I'd lay under that bed, and I loved my daddy, and I hated my daddy. And I knew I'd never be like my daddy. And I used to lay under that bed, and I'd think, boy, when I get big, I'm going to get my mother, and I'm going to get her away from all of this. And little did I know, the same disease that my father had, I was to have also. Grew up in it, you know. It was an exciting family to grow up in. If you caught my last name, it was Adams. We was the Adams family long before they come on television. We provided the weekend entertainment in our neighborhood, you know. There was always something happening at our house. Some of my brothers was always in trouble, you know. We wasn't no different, though, than anybody else in our neighborhood. You know, I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they told me I was from a dysfunctional family. And I had to laugh. This woman told me that, and I said, lady, I want you to know I was from a dysfunctional neighborhood. You know, we wasn't no different than anybody else in our neighborhood. Everybody did the same thing that we did. But, you know, I grew up like that, and I remember as a kid growing up, I would go to a boys' club. And to go to the boys' club, I had to walk up a section of Portland. It was the roughest place in the world. It was called Portland. There was a bar on every corner. And I had all these older brothers, and they was already in these beer joints, and they was fighting and doing all the things that you do in them beer joints. And I remember as a kid, about 9 years old, I'd go to that boys' club, and I had to go past this one particular joint. It was at 29th and Portland. Most fabulous joint in the world. Had a big oval window in the front of it. And I'd go by there, and I'd, as a real little kid, and I'd get up on my tiptoes, and I'd look in there, and the band was playing behind chicken wire, and the tables was bolted to the floor, and my brothers was in there, and they was fighting and stabbing and police running in. And at 9 years old, I thought, my God, I can't wait to get in there. That ain't much of an ambition to grow up with, you know. I was a problem child in school. I never could apply myself in school. I was a class clown. You know, usually when the teacher was writing an assignment up on the blackboard, I'd pick up an eraser or a piece of chalk and I'd bust her upside the head. And all my classmates would laugh. And I found out real early, if you can't get attention with good behavior, man, you can get all you want with bad behavior. And I got my share of it. You know, I remember being somewhere and I was talking about being in school to a buddy of mine. My mother was there. She kept giving me funny looks. And I looked over and I said, Mom, I did go to school. And she said, Larry, I want you to know that I went to school more for you than you did. And that was probably true. I was always in school. You know, I just grew up that way. I found out I liked to perform to the crowd. It got me a lot of attention. I got into high school and it wasn't no different in high school. I finally got old enough to quit school, and by the time I was 16 years old, I weighed less than 100 pounds. And I had a brother, and he was a jockey. And he was a rich, famous jockey at one time in his life. And he rode race horses all over the United States. And I thought, you know, he used to bring jockeys home with him. He'd take him up to them exciting bars where the band played behind chicken wire and the tables was bolted to the floor. And he'd throw $20 bills around like he had just printed them. And I thought, that's it. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going away and become a rich, famous jockey. And I remember going and asking my dad, you know, I said, Dad, I'm going to work on the racetrack. He said, bye. You know, my dad had a rule at our house. It was called 16 and out. And, you know, when you have 13 kids, you better have a rule like that. And with his blessing, away I went, man. At 16 years old, I quit school. And I went on the racetrack to seek my fame and fortune. I went to Boston, Massachusetts. What a place, man. I went up into Boston, and I immediately got on the racetrack and wound up with the people that drink and drug. They was the people that attracted me. Now, if you've never heard about me when I was on the racetrack, don't become too alarmed. Because the only thing I was going to ride was a beach up in Boston called Riviera Beach. And I passed out on that beach night after night after night. And I believe that if you cross a line into alcoholism, I crossed a line at an early age. Because by 16 years old, I'm having blackouts and I'm running the country drinking. You know, I had no supervision at all. And I remember looking up one day at a racetrack and my brother Norman showed up. Now, my brother Norman was 5 years older than me and he was my hero. You know, later on, Norman liked to fight in them beer joints. And he was a great big old husky guy. And when he hit you, you was down. And he liked to fight, and I kept him in training. You know, I'd start him, and he would finish him. But he showed up there in Boston, and I thought, how about that? My brother come 1,000 miles to see me. I found out later he was hiding from the FBI. That's what he was doing up into Boston. He had to leave Louisville. He got up there, and we really got to party. My alcoholism was going full scale. But the FBI come up there and they found my brother and they brought him back to Louisville. And I got real homesick. And, you know, I was wondering what was happening to him. And I hadn't wrote my mother and daddy a letter or called them since I'd been gone. And I remember I thought, well, I'm going to go back to Louisville. And coming home, I thought, boy, I bet my mom and dad will be glad to see me. Can you imagine with 13 kids, I thought they was going to be glad to see me. And I remember sitting in the kitchen and my dad come in from work. And the first thing he said, Christ sakes, are you back again? You know, I didn't like him before, and that didn't add to it. But my dad had got smart while I'd been gone. My brothers had been educating him. He said, Larry, you're not going to lay in that bed all day and hang on them corners at nighttime. If you stay here, you got a man. Well, I don't have to tell you all, I didn't last too long. And it wasn't long with my behavior, my dad asked me to leave. And there's one advantage of having a lot of brothers and sisters. It takes a while to use them up. And I remember going to my brother Ralph's house, and I knocked on his door, and I said, Ralph, Dad run me off. Can I stay all night? He said, yeah, brother, come on in. It took him a year to get me out of his house. I was like bubblegum, boy. When I got in, I stuck, you know. And, you know, I was drinking. I started hanging in them beer joints because, you know, back when I was growing up, where I was growing up, it was easy to get in them beer joints. And I'm hanging in them beer joints, and I'm doing all the things that my brother's doing. Started going to jail a lot for drunk, disorderly conduct. And you know, never once did I think there was anything wrong with that. I thought that was the price you pay to do the things that you wanted to do, and I was willing to pay them that price for a long time. And that's the way I was living. I walked back down in my old neighborhood one day, and I hadn't seen Barbara. I knew Barbara since we was 5 years old. She lived a block and a half from me. And I'd went away from the racetrack, come home, and I hadn't seen her for a good while. I was standing up on that corner, and she come sashaying up that street, and she had grew up, and she had filled out, and she had what I wanted, and I was willing to go on any lengths to get it. And I did. We wound up getting married. Now, we had to sneak around to see each other, and I couldn't understand it. Her daddy absolutely hated me. And I thought, I wonder why her daddy don't like me, a good, upstanding citizen like me. You know, but I was the kind of drunk, I'd be out all night Friday night, and I'd be coming home, and her daddy would be out in the yard cutting grass, and I'd throw a whiskey bottle at him and call him an SB and couldn't understand why he didn't want his daughter to go out with him. Thought he was picking on me. But me and Barbara, we wound up getting married, and we was going to live happily ever after. And guess what, man? We started having kids. Man, we had our first kid right away, and it wasn't long. We had our second kid, and it wasn't long that Barbara was pregnant with our third child. And I thought we was going to have 13 till we found out what was causing it, you know. But our life was already a shambles because my alcoholism was progressing. I'm going to jail on a regular basis. I'm doing everything imaginable. I'm running with the wildest crowd I can find in Louisville, and we'd cruise around in cars on Friday and Saturday night, and if you left something out in your yard, we took it. And you know, I don't have to tell you, when you live like that, sooner or later you have to pay for it. And it wasn't long till I got in some serious trouble, and I remember standing in front of one of them judges I told you a story about. And he sentenced me to 10 years in the Kentucky State Penitentiary. And Barbara was in that courtroom, and she was pregnant with our third child, and she began to cry. And my mother and daddy was in that courtroom, and they began to cry. And I remember looking back thinking, what the hell are they crying for? I'm going to the penitentiary. You know, I tell you that because I was 23 years old and I had lost the ability to care about another human being. And away I went to the penitentiary, man, I was scared to death. And guess what? I got there and all my friends was there. Everybody from my old neighborhood was there. Had an ex-brother-in-law up there, and he was doing a double life sentence. And I remember they said, hey, Larry, what took you so long? And I thought, I wonder how they knew I was coming. You know, well, it's a cinch the way I was living. I'll tell you about being there for a particular reason, because I got in the penitentiary, and one night I'm walking the loop. And if you don't know what the loop is, I'm going to save you a trip to the penitentiary. It's a big old concrete path that goes all the way around the penitentiary. When you ain't got nothing to do, you get out and walk. And I'm walking one day, and a buddy of mine come up and he said, Larry, you want to go to a meeting tonight? You ain't got a great social life in the penitentiary. And I was kind of interested. I said, what kind of meeting? He said, an AA meeting. And I looked at him like he had two heads. I said, what in the world do I want to go to a meeting, an AA meeting for in the penitentiary? And he said something that motivated me. He said, well, might look good to the parole board. I said, where's the meeting at? And I want you to know, for the next 18 months, I went to a meeting every Wednesday night, whether I needed it or not. And I want to tell you tonight that you can come to these meetings and sit in these chairs till your butt falls off. But if you don't absorb something and hear something, it won't do you any good. And I went to them meetings, and they would bring speakers in from the outside world and on Wednesday nights, and they would talk. And I'd sit and listen to them tell their story, and the meeting would get over with, and me and a buddy would start back to the dormitory, and I'd look at him, I'd say, man, that guy's had a rough life, ain't he? Now, he went out the front gate and went home to his wife and children, and I went back and got locked up. When I got to this program, my sponsor told me the word insanity ought to come real easy for me. I could not connect that I was in the penitentiary as a direct result of alcoholism. Barbara had our third child shortly after I went in the penitentiary. She went on Aid for Dependent Children. And I held that baby for the first time behind bars. And Barbara would get on a bus and she would ride up to see me every Sunday. And we'd sit in that distant room and we'd make all them plans. You know, I'd tell her, man, when I get out of here, me, you, and them kids are going to live happily ever after. And I finally made parole and I went home to Barbara and them three kids. And we lived happily ever after for 2 weeks. You know, we went on one of them little honeymoons you got to go on when you've been gone. You got to get caught up. It don't take long to get caught up. And I got bored. And I told her, I said, I'm going to walk up to the corner and see my buddies. And I walked up to my favorite bar. And I walked in. They said, hey, Larry, we're glad you're back. Have a beer. And I hadn't drank nothing for over 2 years. And I picked that bottle of beer up. It's like I never left. We tried a geographical cure. I remember, you know, we bought a house. Barbara really bought the house. She went some money at the racetrack. I remember I took her to the racetrack and she went $500. And Barbara didn't believe in banks back then. She used to hide it. And every time she'd go somewhere, I'd look for that money and I never did find it. And I took her back to the racetrack and she went another $500. And I never did find it. And it wasn't until we was in AA and Al-Anon that I went to hear my wife give a lead. And she told where she used to hide that money. And I like to pass it on to my fellow alcoholic. She hid it in flower pots. So if you're ever looking, turn them flower pots upside down. She don't hide it there anymore, I can tell you that. But she bought this house and we moved out to where we are now in Shively. And we got out into Shively. My wife come up to me one day and she said, Larry, I know what's wrong with you. Barbara always knew what was wrong with me. And I said, really, what's that? And she said, nobody's ever taught you how to drink. And she said, I'm going to take you out tonight and learn you how to be a social drinker. And I thought, if she's buying, I'm going, you know. And we did. We went into a place out on Bardstown Road called the Toy Tiger. You can imagine, man. Real nice place. We went in there and I opened that door and the band was playing. And I got snapping my fingers and I thought, we're going to have a good time tonight. And she ordered me a vodka and orange juice. They set it down. I went to chug-a-lug it up. And she reached over and touched my hand. She said, no, 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 no. She said, you don't drink like that. She said, you sit here and you sip on that and you listen to the music. And she said something I'll never forget. She looked at me and she said, two of these ought to do you while we're here. I thought, boy, we ain't going to be here long. And I remember sitting in that Toy Tiger and sipping on that vodka and orange juice, and I'd look across the table at her and I'd think, damn you, I hate you. You won't let me have no fun. And I stood it as long as I could, and I told her, if this is social drinking, you can have it. And I began to order them drinks like I like to get them, and when we left that night, she helped me out to the car, and she drove home, and she never took me back, so I flunked social drinking. You know, the only social drinking I was going to do after that, if somebody said he was going to have a drink, I'd say, socialize. You know? And things got worse. You know, when you think your alcoholism can't get bad, it gets worse. And our life got worse. You know, our family completely disintegrated. My children grew up without a father. Because I didn't come home a lot. I would land at somebody's house. I would roam the streets of Louisville. And in 1974, I fell on this job. I was a painter by trade. If you heard about drunken painters, that's what I was. And I worked for a rubber company, and I fell in 1974, and I had to be rushed to the hospital to have the first of many back surgeries. And from 1974 to 1978, alcohol and drugs completely consumed me. I picked up a drug habit, too, and I don't talk about it in Alcoholics Anonymous. Out of respect for our traditions, and I also don't talk a whole lot about it because my recovery for all of my addictions is the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't need 15 dozen different programs to confuse me. I just use the 12 steps, and they work pretty good for me. But from 74 to 78, my life was a nightmare. You know, everything that can happen to an alcoholic kept happening over and over and over. I began to lose a lot of weight. You know, you don't pick up a lot of weight when you're eating pickle weenies and pig feet and them beer joints. They just don't do much for putting weight on you. And I ain't going home much because all Barbara's feeding me is cold shoulder and hot tongue, and I didn't like either one of them. She's talking about divorce on a regular basis. You know, my kids, I was an embarrassment to them, and our life was a shambles. And, you know, I just kept on rolling. In 1977, I had a particularly bad weekend. I'm going to tell you about it, and then we're going to talk about recovery. My brother Norman, that one that done all my fighting, he called me up one Friday night, and he said, Larry, they need some painters out the Ford Motor Company. He said, you want to go? He said, they need 25 painters. And I said, count me in, man. I need the money. You know, when you're drinking like I am and you're doing drugs, and you're trying to give the wife a little money and keep the bill collectors off your butt, it takes a lot of money. And I said, pick me up, man. I need the money. He said, will you be ready at 5:30 in the morning? We'll get you. And at 5:30 in the morning, my brother Norman and my nephew Donnie honked a horn. I went out and climbed in the car, and they had a bag of reefer laying on the front seat and a cooler full of vodka and orange juice. And I looked at them at 5:30 in the morning, and they was smashed. And I thought, this is going to be a good job. I knew we was going to have fun that day, you know. And away we went, man. We went out to Ford Motor Company. It wasn't long till that vodka and orange juice was gone. And I told my nephew, Donnie, I said, I'm going home. And he said, what's the matter, Uncle Larry? I said, we ain't got nothing to drink, man. I can't stay here. He said, well, we can't get out of here. And I said, man, you can get out of anywhere. And I looked around, and the guards out there rolled around on little golf carts. And I seen a golf cart, and I went over and pushed the starter button. It started up. Me and my nephew jumped on that golf cart, and away we went. We went up to the gatehouse, parked the golf cart, told him we had to go after some paint. He let us out, and we went to a liquor store. And we got a bottle of whiskey for every pocket we had. I had five brothers on that job, and I knew I needed to get quite a lot to take back. And I told my nephew, I said, we better go back. My brother Norman was there, and I knew he was rampaging. And we went back, and as we went through the gatehouse, this guard seen a bottle of whiskey in my nephew's pocket, and he grabbed it. And needless to say, we got kind of belligerent with him. And he said, well, I don't know what to do with you guys. I'm going to call the captain. And when he went to use the phone, we snatched up that bottle of whiskey he'd grabbed. We run out and jumped on that golf cart, and away we went. And my nephew said, Uncle Larry, they're coming after us. And I looked back, and there was two guards, and they was on a golf cart. And they was starting to gain on us. And he said, you better open this thing up. I said, man, I got it as wide open as it'll go. He said, well, we better do something, or we're going to get caught. So I rounded this corner, and when I did, I looked over at this building, and it was the shiningest fire engine I ever seen in my life. And I hadn't drove one before, and I haven't drove one since. But I was drunk enough that day to try that one, you know. And we pulled over, and we jumped in that fire engine. It had a set of keys in it. We cranked it up. Now, I don't know about y'all, but you can't drive a fire engine until you get the light and the siren going. And we figured out how to get that light and that siren going, and away we went, man. I remember my nephew looking back at them guards waving. But you know, I told you I liked a lot of attention. I looked at my nephew and I said, you know, it would be a shame not to let my brother see this fire engine. I know they want to see it. So I told him to hold on. And we went down through this plant. We went through a building. They was working in the back of it. And this hallway was just big enough to get that fire engine down through there. And that light was going and that siren was going and people was a-diving out of our way. And my nephew was hollering, run over them SBs, Uncle Larry, kill him. Had you stopped that fire engine that very moment and said, one of you guys is going to the penitentiary, I'd have said, so what? By the grace of a loving, merciful God, I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous almost 20 years. And my nephew was going to spend the next 14 years in the penitentiary. God works in strange ways. But we took it to where my brothers was, and they was real impressed. Their eyes got big and their mouth fell open. And every guard at the Ford Motor Company was impressed too because they all showed up. And they was mad as wet hens. And they got up into my face and one of these guards pushed me. Well, I told y'all my brother Norman done my fighting. And when this guard pushed me, my brother Norman hit him upside the head. And we had one of the biggest free-for-alls out there you ever seen in your life. Now, I used to tell this story in my favorite beer joint and went something like this. That we whipped every guard at the Ford Motor Company. But when I got to you people, you learned me about a word I hated. It was called honesty. I got to tell you what really happened out there. We got the shit beat out of us. Yeah. And I was the littlest and I got the worst, believe me. They mopped the floor up with me. I had a hinky on the side of my head as big as a watermelon. And you know, they didn't lock us up. They threw us out of the Ford Motor Company. Me and my brother Norman and my nephew Donnie, and we stood outside and we said, we'll be back. We're going home and get our pistols and we'll come back and show you how bad we are. But we got detained along the way. We run into a beer joint. Now, I'd been out since 5:30 that morning. Just told you what kind of day I had. Hadn't had enough. I went home to get an old LTD station wagon. I had one of them drunk carts. Had dents all over it. My nephew took off, and I tried to catch him. The last thing I remember, I was doing 90 miles an hour. And I must have passed out at the wheel, and I wrecked that car. I turned it over five times, and I hit five trees. I don't even remember this wreck. I come to find out later that my son was the first person to arrive at the scene of the wreck, and he knew his daddy was dead. And he pulled me out of that wreck, and he said it had knocked the shoes off my feet. And that I was spitting dirt wanting a cigarette. Now my son, he grew up with my alcoholism. And he knew if he left me there that I was going to get locked up. So he took me home. And I don't remember none of this, but I remember waking up the next morning. Now I want you to know that when I married Barbara, she was a good Christian girl. She went to a religious school. She studied the Bible. She didn't cuss. She didn't drink. She didn't smoke. She didn't gamble. She didn't know how to have any fun. But I want to tell you what happens with the disease of alcoholism. They begin to change. And this morning when I woke up, Barbara had changed into an attack dog. She was sitting on my chest and she had that finger going. And she began to tell me all the things that I'd done the night before. And she told me about this wreck. And I said, if I had a wreck like that, I'd be dead. And she took me over to the junkyard and I looked at that wreck. And I looked at her and I said, that's it. I'll never drink again. Any of y'all ever quit for never? Man, that's a long time. I got drunk at night, you know. I just couldn't quit drinking. And I was in bad shape, you know. I had a bad weekend. I had some broken ribs from the wreck. I was all beat up from that fight. And I got up on Monday morning and I went to my regular job. Now, I went over to the paint shop and we had everybody that drink and drug come to the paint shop. And we used to have fun in that paint shop. We used to line up a bunch of chairs, and we could watch the planks so nobody'd slip up on us. And we'd roll them funny little cigarettes, and we'd blast off at 7 o'clock in the morning, and we'd have a couple hours of real fun. We'd sit in them chairs and go. Ain't that living, you know? I thought we was really living. But the phone rang this morning in 1977, and it was personnel director. And he said, Larry, I'm going to see you over in my office. And all my buddies said, what's Bill want with you? I said, he probably wants to give me a raise. And I went over to his office, and I'll never forget, he was looking out a window. And he turned around and looked at me. I probably weigh 115 pounds. I'm all beat up. I've got a big hanky on the side of my head. I can't hardly breathe with broken ribs. And he looked at me and he said, my God, Larry, you look awful. I thought, man, if you just had the kind of weekend I had, you wouldn't look too hot either. But I wasn't going to tell him about it. But to my knowledge, he was the first person to ever call me an alcoholic. He looked at me that morning. He said, Larry, I know what's wrong with you. And I said, really, Bill, what's that? And he said, you're an alcoholic. And I know a place that can help you. And I got fighting mad. I gave him a good cussing, and I stomped out of his office. And I went back over to the paint shop, and all my buddies said, what'd Bill want with you? I said, you all will never believe what he called me. He said, really, what's that? And I said, he said, I'm an alcoholic. He said, oh, he tells everybody that. Come on, have a beer. Y'all know who I believe, don't you? I thought, yeah, I never seen this guy take a drink. He didn't know nothing. And I left his office, and that was in 1977, and I continued to drink for another year. And I took my wife, children, mother, daddy, brothers, sisters, anybody that cared anything about me, and I took them straight into the jaws of hell. Because everything that can happen to an alcoholic and his loved ones happened to us over and over and over that last year. A year after I left that man's office, I'd been out with my brother Norman on a 3-day drunk, and as a result of that drunk, I overdosed on alcohol and drugs. And when I come to, I was in University Hospital in Louisville, Kentucky, and I was strapped down on a gurney. And they had a tube in every hole I had. And I was sick as a dog. And I'm laying on that gurney all strapped down, and a woman walked up. And I found out later she was a psychiatrist. And she said, Larry, we're going to put you upstairs. And I thought, upstairs, University Hospital, that's the nut ward. Because my brother had wound up there. And I thought, man, she's going to lock me up. So I began to con and manipulate like I had done all my life. And I looked at her and I said, lady, if you'll let me out of this hospital, I'm going to do something about my drinking. And she said, do you really mean that, Larry? And I'm laying on a gurney with straps on my legs and my arms and my hands and my waist, but I could get my sworn hand up. And I looked up at her and I said, I swear to God, if you let me out of here, I'm going to do something. And you know, she bought my story. And she let me out of that hospital, and I did do something. I stopped at the first beer joint I could find and got me a six-pack because that's all I knew to do. You know, alcohol had me by the throat and was taking me down. And I got out of that hospital, and I drank that weekend. And on Monday morning, November the 7th of 1978, I had no idea that I was about to begin a journey into Alcoholics Anonymous. I got up and went into work, and as I went to go over to the paint shop, I passed that personnel director's office. And I remember what he had told me in 1977, that I was an alcoholic, and he knew a place that could help me. And I went up and tried his door, and he wasn't in. And I went around to the side door. It was real dark. He usually come in the side, and he wasn't there. And I remember how I felt that morning. And I hope I never forget how I felt that morning, because I sat on them steps, and I cried. Because I knew that I couldn't go no further. And I knew that if I got up off them steps and I went to that paint shop, I was never, ever going to get back. And he come in and seen me sitting on the steps, and I said, Bill, you told me about a place that can help a person like me. Where is it? And he told me about a treatment center. And I said, well, I'll go tomorrow. He said, oh, no, you're going right now. And he called Barbara up, and they took me up to a treatment center, and I stayed 28 days. And a lot of things happened to me in that treatment center, but the most important thing that happened to me is they thoroughly introduced me to a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. I stayed 30 days, and I'm going to tell you how sick I was. I went home to a wife and 3 teenage children, and I thought we was going to be the Beaver family. Oh, God, it was awful. You know, I went home and I set my 3 teenage children by now. I set them down to the table and I said, things are going to be different. And my youngest daughter went, oh no. And it made me mad. I went to a meeting that night and I met my sponsor and I told him, my first sponsor was named Dave. And I said, Dave, my family don't believe me. And he said, hell, I don't believe you either. He said, all we got to go on is your track record. He said, how many times you told your family you ain't going to drink? I said, about a million. And he told me something that night I hope I never forget. He said, the greatest talk you'll ever make is the one you walk. Now, I'd like to tell you that we was the instant happy Adams family, but it was awful at our house. It was awful. I remember going to my first AA meeting. And I walked in, I sat down, a guy come up to me. And he said, hi, welcome to the Shabby Group. My name's Bob. And I really didn't even want to talk to this guy. And he sat down and started making small talk with me. And I had about a half a cup of coffee. And I said, how long have you been sober? And he said, 16 years. And I almost spit my coffee on him. I thought, 16 years, man. Ain't nobody stays sober that long. And he got up to leave. And I remember thinking, I bet that's the biggest liar in AA. And then I remember thinking, I wonder if I touch him, if it'll work for me. Now, I never touched Bob, but I believe God touched me that night because I've been coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous over and over and over. Things was bad at our house. I had these three teenage children, and I used to hold court at the kitchen table. Any of y'all do that while they're trying to have dinner? And, you know, these three teenagers is rebelling. I hadn't been in their life, hadn't been giving them no rules, and I start setting curfews down, and boy, it was awful at our dinner table. And they wouldn't listen, and I would have to bang on the table, and my favorite language at that time was profanity, and man, it was awful. And you know, every once in a while I'd have to throw a temper fit. Any of y'all ever threw a temper fit sober? I'd jump up and down and bang on the countertop. And a guy in AA told me, he said, Larry, you know what's wrong with you? And I said, what? And he said, you got a little brat inside of you, and his name's Buster. And he said, Buster's controlling your life. You need to spank his ass and put him to bed. Boy, Buster was controlling my life. And I ain't real careful today, Buster will control my life, you know. But it was awful at my house, you know. And I'm going to meetings. Barbara began to go to Al-Anon. Now, I didn't want Barbara to go to Al-Anon. I met her Al-Anon sponsor. And if you'd asked me who I hated the worst when I got here, I'd have told you it was her Al-Anon sponsor. Oh, that woman was horrible. I remember she come out of the Al-Anon room one night, her and her sponsor, and I walked up and I said, I guess y'all been talking about me. And she said, you skinny little shrimp, what makes you think we'd waste an hour on you? I thought, man, I got to get her away from me. I knew I had to get Barbara away from her because Barbara's beginning to say strange things to me. You know, I'd tell her something and try to provoke an argument, and she'd say, you could be right. Oh, I wanted to kill her. You know, you could be right. All them little Al-Anon saying, you know. Oh, it made me sick. And, you know, I used to hold my sobriety like a club over her. She didn't do just what I wanted her to. I'd tell her, I'd say, I get drunk. Boy, she'd snap too. But Al-Anon changed that too. You know, I remember one night she wasn't doing what I wanted her to, and I said, I'll get drunk. She wheeled around, got that close to my face, and she said, who gives a shit? Yeah. She said, your sobriety is your responsibility. I'll not take no credit for it, and I'll not take no blame for it. I thought, I've got to get her away from that woman. Now, the only person that I hated worse than her Al-Anon sponsor was her Al-Anon sponsor's husband. He was in AA. I hated this guy with a passion, man. He talked to me like a dog. I'd go to him and tell him something Barbara done. He'd say, she ought to Kroger bag you. I said, hey, man, he ain't got no sympathy at all. Louie used a lot of four-letter words. And Louie and Nancy began to try and get me and Barbara to go places with AAs and Al-Anons. And I'd tell Barbara, I'd say, if that Louie calls, you tell him we ain't going. And Louie would call and Barbara would hand me the phone. And I'd say, hi, Louie, what time you going to pick us up? I was scared of old Louie. And we began to go places with AAs and Al-Anons. You know, by now our children had left. My son starts falling in the back door drunk and loaded on grass. I thought, how can he do this to me, as good of a daddy as I've been to this kid? You know, and I thought I had enough experience that I'd straighten him out. If any of y'all's trying to straighten out your son or daughter, good luck. You know, because the more I tried, the worse it got. My son left home and joined the Navy. You know, he was really wanting to get away. My two daughters left home, went to Texas to live with my sister. That left me and Barbara. Now, you talk about two sorry people. We used to sit at the table and just stare at each other. We didn't know how to communicate. All we ever talked about is what I'd done the night before. Now I'm in AA, and, you know, we ain't got nothing to talk about. AA and Al-Anon give us our first link together. We begin to talk about something that we'd heard at a meeting. You know, I didn't know how to be a husband. I hadn't been no husband. I'd been in a beer joint all my life, out on the streets. It was AA and Al-Anon couples that learned me and Barbara how to be a couple. I didn't know how to be a husband. You know, I didn't know how to even treat Barbara. And I began to watch by example, and I think that's the most important thing we've got going in this program, just watching by example. And AA and Al-Anon couples began to give us examples. I remember they got me and Barbara one, I think it was a New Year's, and we went with 50 AA and Al-Anon couples, and we went to see a play. It was called Camelot. And I remember, man, I'd never seen a play like Camelot. We was at this big fine place. They had a intermission, halftime, whatever you call a play. And I went outside to smoke a cigarette, and one of my big tough buddies from Portland was out there, and he said, "Larry, I didn't know you liked this kind of stuff." I said, "Hell, I didn't either." You know, I'd never experienced nothing like that. And we began to go to conferences. You know, we began to go to roundups and things like this, and our life began to come together. We began to meet people, and we began to fall back in love again. And that was a long journey. It's been a long journey. You know, our kids was gone, and Barbara was going to Al-Anon, and I was going to AA. And, you know, a year went by, and I got my token in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous, is all I can tell you. I wanted to give this program to the world. And, you know, I used to get in my car. I would ride down in Louisville, in downtown Louisville. There was an old abandoned hospital down there. And me and another guy got me a pigeon, and that was dangerous because I didn't know nothing myself. And I got this guy, and we would ride downtown in downtown Louisville, and these old winos would crawl up in these bushes at nighttime, and we'd drag them out of them bushes and take them to detox. Now, they didn't want to go to detox, and detox didn't want them. You know, and they would call my sponsor, and they'd say, "You got to do something with Larry." He'd say, "Oh, leave him alone. He's on his white horse." And, you know, it got so bad that when my car would go down Oak Street downtown, them little old winos would take off running. I had a marked car, you know, but I was having the time of my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've had the time of my life ever since I've been in this fellowship. You know, I fell in love with it. You know, I remember I had to change sponsors. My first sponsor, well, he did help me through the steps. I remember going to him after about a year, and I said, "Dave, there's something wrong with me. Don't ever tell your sponsor that." You know, he said, "There's a whole lot wrong with you, Larry." He said, "What's the matter?" And I said, "I see people around AA. It's got something I've never touched." And he said, "Yeah." And he said, "Like what?" And I said, "I don't know, man. I see it in their eyes, and I hear it in their voice." And I said, "Inside of me, I ain't drink nothing, but inside I don't feel right." He said, "You want more?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "You got to do more." And I said, "Like what?" He said, "Like the 12 steps. I hadn't picked up the book in a year. I hadn't worked a step. I was as dry as you can be." And you know, I heard a guy say, "If dry is all you can be in this program, you might as well be drunk." I'm going to tell you what, I don't believe that. If you're sitting here tonight and you're dry, stay here. Because you've got to be dry to get sober. And I was as dry as popcorn. But he began to help me with the steps. And I remember we went through the first three steps. And me and him knelt and prayed and said the third step. And I said, "What do I do now?" And he said, "You got to do a four step, an inventory." I said, "I've done an inventory." He said, "Yeah, but it's been your wife and kids and everybody around AA." He said, "You got to do one of yourself." And with his help, for the first time in my life, I sat down with a pencil and a piece of paper, and I looked at this immature, spoiled little brat that had never grew up, that had blamed people all his life for his misery. I was 38 years old when I got to this program. That's not a pretty picture. And I remember after I got that fourth step, I said, what do I do now? And he said, you've got to read it to somebody, preferably me. And me and him sat in a park, and for the first time in my life, I took my false face off. Because see, when I was 12 years old and I took my first drink, I put a false face on. And I was whatever the crowd wanted me to be. I played to the crowd. And I was never able to let you see what I was like inside. But for the first time in my life, I shared myself with another human being in the God of my understanding. You see, I found God in this program. And that was a good feeling. And I remember after I did the fifth step, he said, now you can begin to fill your insides with what this program has to offer. And that's been my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want it all. You know, my kids was gone. I'd changed sponsors and I got Jack, and I used to go and cry about my kids. I said, man, all my kids are gone. I wish they'd come home. And he'd say, be careful what you pray for. Guess what? My children did begin to come home. And God knew better than me. He didn't bring my children home all at one time. He brought them one at a time. We'd all got together, we'd have killed each other. He brought my youngest daughter home first. Her name's Sharon. And we began to have a relationship with Sharon, me and her mother. And she lived with us, and she come home, she got a job. I remember after she was home, she come in one day, and she was all excited. She was working for a bank. She said, Dad, I got some tickets to the ballet. And I thought, whoopee. She said, will you and Mom go? And, you know, we wanted to be with our daughter. And I said, yeah, we'll go. And we got all dressed up, you know. And we went down to the Kentucky Center for the Arts in Louisville. Great big, beautiful building. She had some seats about three rows back in the middle. We sat down there waiting for this ballet to start. This woman come out on the stage, and she made a fatal mistake. She said, hi, my name's Kathy. And I hollered, hi, Kathy. Now, I want you to know I was the only one in that auditorium that hollered, hi, Kathy. My daughter wanted to crawl under the seat. She said, Dad, you can't take you no place Alcoholics Anonymous has run to. But we began to have a relationship with her, and that's been an ongoing relationship, you know. She lived with us for a while. She got married, went through a divorce. She's remarried. She wouldn't let me pick her husband. I don't like her husband. They moved to Colorado. I'm really not happy about all of that, but I'm trying to let her live her life. I finally learned how to do that. I have to let my children do whatever they got to do, and that's hard to do. My oldest daughter moved to Texas, got married, had some grandbabies. And I used to say, man, I wish she'd moved closer to Kentucky with them grandbabies. My sponsor said, be careful what you pray for. Guess what? She left her husband. She moved close to our house. She moved in my house with a four-year-old and a six-year-old. My wife's working. By now, I'm retired on disability. My daughter got a job, and guess who babysit? Oh, Grandpa. I babysitted a six-year-old and a four-year-old. Now, we used to take the six-year-old to school, and me and a four-year-old spent the day together. I told my sponsor, Jack, I said, me and that four-year-old get along. He said, you are two, y'all the same age. You just can't get ahead of them sponsors. But I'm going to tell you what, me and that four-year-old used to get everybody off to work and school, me and him go to a video store. And we'd get a video, we'd bring it home, and I'd fix him a snack, and we got a great big old king-size bed with a bunch of pillows. And me and him get up there, and I'd pop that video in. You know where he'd get? Right in the crook of my arm. And we'd watch him kids' movies, and every once in a while he'd reach over and kiss me on the cheek. He'd say, I love you, Paw-Paw. You can have my drink tonight. Them two little fellas has never seen their grandfather drunk. They've never seen me in a drunken rage run their grandmother out of the house. They think I hang the moon, and I agree with them, you know. My daughter got back with her husband, and, you know, everybody said, you're going to cry when them kids leave. I said, just till they get out of the driveway. I found out I could love them in Texas, too. But my daughter went back, and she went through a divorce, and she got through that divorce, and she just not too long ago married a real nice guy. I love him dearly, and they've got a wonderful life. He's got two kids, a little boy and a little girl. You know, she's happy, and me and her's got a good relationship, and you know, she calls me on the phone sometimes when we talk in our. And this same daughter hated my guts so bad when she left home that she wouldn't have spit on me if I was on fire. And thanks to this program and the God of my understanding, today we love each other. My son David, chip off the old block. He's done everything his father's done. You know, David's been in and out of jail. He's been to the penitentiary. He come to this program, he got a year and went out to celebrate. He come back and he got another year and went out to celebrate. And I have watched, me and Barbara has watched David till her heart's been about to break. David's lived on the streets. He's robbed our home. He's done everything, and we had to let go of him. And there was times that we didn't know if our son was alive or dead. And we shed many a tear, and we said many a prayer to the God of our understanding to take care of him. And I want to tell you how God works. I was supposed to go down in Louisiana to talk, and I did not want to go. My back was bothering me, and I didn't feel good. And I told Barbara it was time to go, and I said, I'm going to call and cancel. And she said, oh, we ought to go. And we went down to Louisiana, I think it was Lafayette, and we went down there to talk, and I didn't want to be there. I got through talking, and my daughter from Texas had come over to that conference, and she come up, and she said, Dad, there's a guy over there who wants to talk to you. And I said, honey, tell him I'll talk to him tomorrow. I said, I'm feeling bad, and I just want to go to the room. And she said, oh, Dad, he's such a nice guy. Please talk to him. And I went and talked to this guy, and he was become one of my dearest friends. And we began to communicate, and him and his wife and me and Barbara, we'd been to their house, and they'd been to our house. He knew all about David. And I'm talking to him on the phone one day, and David come by to hustle me for some money. And he said, what are you doing? I said, oh, I'm sitting here talking to David. He said, let me talk to David. He knew all about David. Now, this guy had never met my son, but he got David on the phone, and he invited my son to come down to Louisiana and live with him and his wife. A place I didn't want to go, and a guy I didn't even want to talk to. And God was to bring the guy. It was to get my son back to this fellowship. I remember he gave me back the phone. He said, will you buy David a ticket down here? I said, one way. And my son went down to Louisiana, and he lived with this guy and his wife, and they treated him wonderful. And he got sober, and he called me, and he wanted to know if he could come home. And he lives today with me and Barbara. He's home, and we have a good relationship. You know, today I'm not David's sponsor. I'm just his father. I love him when he's good, and I love him when he's bad. And I want you to know that David's got 10 months of sobriety. And on November, when I celebrate 20 years, if David stays sober and I stay sober, he's going to celebrate a year in November too. And he said, Dad, between us, we'll be 21. I said, yeah, we're growing up together, son. And David's a good boy. He's got a good heart, and he's a wonderful kid. And it's took a lot of AA meetings, and it's took a lot of Al-Anon meetings for me and Barbara to let go of her children and let them live their own lives. And you know, they're all doing pretty good without any help from us. And God has been so good to us. You know, I was lucky enough to see some of my family come in. I got a few more minutes. I know I'm supposed to be done, but I'm not ready to quit. My brother Norman, you know that big old tough guy, he called me up one day and he said, take me up to that hospital. I said, how come? He said, they can help you, they can help me. And my brother Norman become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, big tough guy. He wouldn't even let a woman hug him, much less a man. And, you know, he wouldn't hold hands at meetings. And you know what happened to my brother? The same thing that happened to me. The most powerful force in the world is right here in these rooms, and it's called love. You people love my brother like you love me. And my brother got sober in this program, and me and him and Barbara and his wife, we began to go to conferences, and we began to have a wonderful time. And my brother was 3 years sober in this program, and he called me up, and he said, man, I got some bad news today. And I said, what's up, brother? And he said, I got cancer. I said, how bad? He said, I don't know, but I want you to go back to the doctor with me. And we went back to the doctor. My brother had terminal cancer. And he was my hero. You know, he'd done all my fighting. If I had a problem, I went to Norm. And Norman lived exactly 3 months. And most of that 3 months, he lived in a hospital. And at nighttime, when everybody would leave, I would go up and stay with my brother. And I would pull a chair up by the bed, and I'd say, what do you want to do tonight, Norm? And you say, why don't you read to me from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous? And we talked about God. And we talked about love. And we talked about death. And I remember one night Norman laying in bed and he was laughing. I said, what are you laughing about, Norman? He said, hey. I said, what's so funny? He said, they laugh when they're supposed to cry and they cry when they're supposed to laugh. He said, but I love them. And you know, sometimes at 2 o'clock in the morning, I'd be watching my brother suffer in that bed, and I couldn't hardly stand it. And I want you to know that some AA or some Al-Anon would slip up to the emergency room and check on these two big tough guys from Portland. And when my brother died, I had a hole in me as big as the state of Texas. I thought, I can't go on. And I learned in this program to ask God for the strength to get through the hard spots. And I would hit my knees and I would ask God to help me. And I want to tell you what God began to do. He began to bring me some of the worst guys to sponsor on the face of the earth. He began to bring me guys just like my brother. Big, tough guys. And I want to tell you what, they got me out of myself. And that's the most important thing that you can do in Alcoholics Anonymous, is to give this program away. You know, it's pretty hard when I want to stay home and feel sorry for myself, and one of them guys calls you up and says, where are we going tonight? When they put that we, you're dead, you know. And they got me to meetings when I couldn't have got myself to meetings. And I owe them guys a debt of gratitude. And I don't know how I can ever repay that. I started going on, you know, I want to tell you a little bit about my dad. I was sober in this program. I was 2 years sober. My dad was in his 80s. And my sponsor called me up one night and he said, you want to go to a meeting tonight? I said, I can't go. He said, why not? I said, my old man, that's what I called him. My old man's in the hospital. I said, I got to go see him. He said, don't you want to? I said, not particularly. He said, how come? I said, well, he never done nothing for me but make my life miserable. He said, Larry, how come you can't forgive your dad? He said, you want your children to forgive you. He said, how in the world can you say the Lord's Prayer at the end of an AA meeting and ask God to forgive you your trespasses and carry that resentment towards your father? Boy, he gave me a lot to think about. He said, you don't hate your father. You hated the things that your father doing. And he did them things because of a disease called alcoholism. And I went to see my dad that night. He was in his 80s and I was 40 years old. And I walked into that hospital and I looked at my dad. I knew I didn't hate my dad. Yeah, I hated the things he done. But I sat down on my dad's bed and for the first time I can ever remember, I took my dad's hand and I looked at him and I said, Dad, I just want you to know that I love you. I had never said them words to my father. And I seen a tear come out on my father's cheek. And he said, I love you too, son. My friends, that disease of alcoholism, it divides fathers and sons, mothers and daughters and brothers and sisters. And me and my dad was able to start a relationship. My dad lived to be 93 years old. I'm from good stock. You know, and my dad was one of my best friends after that. Me and him got to be real good friends, and I never left my dad after that, that I didn't rub his white hair. And I didn't kiss him on the cheek and tell him I love you. I tell you this story tonight because there may be somebody in your life that you need to make amends to. Don't wait and have to go to the graveyard. My dad was one of my best friends. And I'm so grateful that this program taught me how to make amends. After my dad died, my mom lived by herself and me and my brothers took care of her in an apartment. And she lived for 10 years in that apartment. She finally got so bad that we had to have a little meeting among the family, and after we had that meeting, they decided that Mom was going to move in with me and Bart. You remember when I was a kid under that bed and I said, someday I'm going to take care of my mother? When I get big, God must have figured I was big, because my mother come and spent 15 months with me and Barbara, and it was a real adjustment. You know, she's 93 years old. She'll be 94 in October. And about 3 months ago, my mom fell on our front porch and she broke her hip and she's in a nursing home. I'm so grateful that God gave me that opportunity to take care of my mother. And I didn't do that because I'm such a great guy. I did that because of you people because of the 12 steps that a wonderful God I know today taught me to live different. And it taught me how to make amends to the people I hurt the most. And I got that opportunity. And my mother's failing now. And I don't know how long she'll be with us. But I know that I got to spend that time with her. And I'm so grateful. God has been so good to me. I want you to know that I wouldn't take $1 million for where I'm standing tonight. But I also want you to know I'd give it away for one drink if I'm not real careful. How do I know? I've watched it. I've seen it time and time again in this program. All I need to do is get away from this program. And you know, when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, if you'd ask me what my greatest fear was, I said, what am I going to tell my friends? When I walked out of that treatment center, I just wondered what I was going to tell my friends when they wanted me to drink and drug. And I believe that this God I know today that has granted me this sobriety gives you what you need when you need it. And I want to tell you tonight that if you're an alcoholic or you're an Al-Anon and you're sitting in this meeting tonight, you've got the most precious gift that God can give you. And I never forget to thank God for it. Every night I thank God for the gift of life and the gift of sobriety. Because God literally picked me up out of a gutter and He brought me to you wonderful people. And my life hasn't been the same. And I believe on a daily basis God has given me what I need. I've had several back surgeries and I had to have one surgery. I had to have 5 units of blood. They told me they was going to take my own blood. And I said, I ain't got 5 units of blood in me. And I didn't. They could only squeeze 2 out of me. And I had to have blood donated by some of the guys that I run around with. Now, one of them's name's Craig, and Craig's the laziest guy in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I have a day and I don't want to do nothing, I tell Barbara Craig's blood's acting up. Another one's name's Bobby. Bobby's fairly new in the program, and he's real crazy, and when I have one of them goofy days, I tell her it's Bobby's blood. And another one's a young guy named Todd, and Todd likes to chase the ladies. And if Barbara catches me looking at one of you pretty ladies too long, I tell her it's Todd's blood acting up. But recently I had to have another surgery, and they told me I had to have 2 more units of blood. And old Craig, the lazy one, went back up and gave me another shot. And my sponsor, Jack, said, I'm going to give you some blood. I said, oh, Jack, you're too old. Jack's been sober about 35, 36 years. I said, you're too old to give blood. And he said, I want you to finally have some aristocratic blood in your family. Now, any of y'all know Jack, he was an old wine old that slept in a cardboard box out by Churchill Downs, and damn if he don't think he's got royal blood. And I remember his wife, Gay, said, oh my God, your blood and Larry's personality, we've created a monster. But I'm proud to have my sponsor's blood in me, and I hope that I can be 1/10 of a member of Alcoholics Anonymous that he's been. You know, he don't tell me nothing. He shows me by example, and he's been a wonderful sponsor for me. And we make a lot of meetings together. I'm very fortunate that my sponsor's active in this program. He's down Mobile at the Southeastern talking tonight. I told him we had the South covered tonight. And I love Jack, you know. He's been good for me. AA has been the most wonderful gift that I've ever received. But I told you when I walked out of that treatment center, I thought, what am I going to tell my friends? And I believe that God gives you what you need when you need it. And God give me a poem. And I'd like to close with this poem because it's what to tell your friends. And before I close, I want to thank Jerry and the committee for having me here. We've had a wonderful time and your hospitality has been wonderful. Thank you all. And I want to close with this poem, and it's called Which Place? It's an AA member's dream. I've put my glasses on. I'm getting old. And it said, I dreamed one night I passed away and left this world behind. I started down that lonely trail, some of my friends to find. I came to a signboard on the trail, the directions it did tell. Keep right to heaven, turn left to hell. I hadn't been too good on earth, just a hopeless boozing rake. I knew there at the crossroads the path I'd have to take. I started down the rocky path that leads to Satan's place. I shook within, not knowing what I'd have to face. Oh, Satan met me at the gate. What's your name, my friend? I'm just old sober sand that came to a sad end. He glanced through the yellow files. You made a mistake, I feared. You're listed as an alcoholic. We don't want you here. I said, I'm looking for my friends. And a smile stole over his face. If your friends are alcoholics, they're any other place. So I went back the way I came to the crossroads I did see. Then I turned right to heaven, as happy as could be. St. Pete smiled and said, come in. For you, I have a berth. You are an alcoholic. You've had a hell on earth. I saw old Bud, Pete, and a friend called Bell. And brother, I was tickled because I thought they'd gone to hell. So brothers, I'll take warning. Learn something from my trip. You've got a place in heaven if you try hard not to slip. If someone tempts you with a drink when you're not feeling well, just tell them you're going to heaven and they can go to hell. Thank you all and God bless you.